Now, time for us to catch up on stories making headlines around the world on this week's World Report with Sharon Lynch.
Good morning. On today's programme, Kamala Harris in Africa and Parisians vote to ban rental e-scooters. But first we go to Russia, where Moscow has formally charged US journalist Evan Gerskovich with espionage, according to Russian news agencies. The Wall Street Journal correspondent has denied the accusations. The arrest has prompted an outcry from media outlets and rights groups, as well as government officials in Washington. From Moscow, fellow Russian journalist Johnny Tickle reports.
The world of Western journalists in Russia is very small. And to some extent, everyone knows everyone. No matter who you work for, where you're from, or how long you've been in the country, the Moscow press corps is rather tight-knit. In the 14 months since Russian President Vladimir Putin launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the number of Westerners still living and working in Moscow has dwindled, including journalists. Now, there are very few reporters left on the ground in Russia's capital, making their work a vital aspect of understanding the most important news story of our time. One of these journalists is Evan Gershkovich, an American working for the Wall Street Journal. Evan is one of the best to have reported on Russia in recent years and spent the entirety of 2022 and the start of 2023 meticulously covering the war in Ukraine from inside Russia, from deaths on the front line to anti-war protests in Moscow. Evan also filed reports for this very program. With many journalists choosing to leave or being forced to leave the country following the invasion of Ukraine, Evan believes that reporting on Russia with an eyes-on-the-ground perspective is absolutely essential and worth taking the risks associated with covering such a sensitive topic in an authoritarian country with increasingly strict laws on media freedom. On March 29th, while investigating a story in Yekaterinburg, a city 1,500 kilometres east of Moscow, Evan was arrested by the FSB, known in English as the Federal Security Service, and the successor to the Soviet Union's notorious KGB. He was then taken to Moscow and put in front of a judge, where it was revealed that he was under arrest for espionage, a charge that carries a maximum sentence of 20 years. He's the first foreign journalist to be arrested by Russia and accused of being a spy since Nicholas Danilov in 1986. The arrest of Evan came as a jarring reality check for Western journalists operating in Russia. For years, international correspondents stationed in the country had been covering the trials of Russian journalists who had crossed the line of what the government deemed acceptable. Despite this, it was widely thought that accredited Western journalists were safe and protected from such treatment, particularly if their work was published abroad in a foreign language. While Evan was not naive and undoubtedly understood the dangers involved in investigating Russia's war in Ukraine, especially in such a sensitive and paranoid environment, the fact remains that nobody thought that the Russian security apparatus would target him, a talented journalist from a prestigious Western newspaper, and imprison him for simply doing his job. On a personal level, I don't know Evan particularly well. While, of course, we have met in Moscow and the majority of our communication has been online, unlike many others in journalism, Evan is always kind, open, willing to help, never jealous of other people's exclusives or scoops. The outpouring for him on social media from his colleagues tells the whole story. Evan is much appreciated, both personally and professionally. What's more, unlike many other journalists in Moscow, Evan genuinely loves Russia. Born to Soviet emigres in the US, Evan was raised speaking Russian and, after some time working in Moscow, developed a deep appreciation for the country. Years later, he would then be arrested and sent to sit in Lefortovo prison, notorious throughout both the Soviet Union and modern-day Russia for being home to the most prominent anti-government dissidents and other political prisoners. For many of us living and working in Russia, Evan's arrest is not only the unjust detention of a colleague, friend, or mere acquaintance, but a sign that things are rapidly changing in Moscow. In the past, despite what many others thought, working as a foreign journalist here in Russia was rather danger-free. Now, one of those journalists has become a target in a wider war perpetrated by the Kremlin against the West. On a micro level, this is a tremendous injustice against an innocent and hard-working reporter. On a larger scale, it's just another step in Russia's drift towards jingoistic, anti-Western authoritarianism. And I'm sure there'll be many more steps to come. This is Johnny Tickle in Moscow for World Report.
To France next, where Parisians have voted to ban rental electric scooters from the streets of the capital. Paris will be cleared from shared e-scooters by September 1st. From Marseille, Mary Fitzgerald reports.
The French call them trottinettes, and at least in my experience, they rarely come up in conversation here without some colourful language or even an expletive or two. Now it seems French frustrations over electric scooters are reaching a tipping point. Last weekend, a majority of Parisians who took part in a referendum on rental electric scooters voted to ban them from the capital. The move does not mean Paris will be scooter-free, as privately owned scooters are exempt. Other cities, including my adopted hometown of Marseille, France's second largest city, are considering similar measures. 5 years ago, Paris was one of the first European capitals to embrace rental electric scooters. It went on to become one of the largest markets in the world for what was initially presented as an environmentally friendly mode of transport. But the public mood soured as the number of scooter-related deaths and serious injuries rose. Attempts to regulate scooters, including rules that banned their use on pavements, had little impact. The death of a woman in Paris 2 years ago galvanized calls for a ban. The victim was hit by two women riding a single scooter while she was walking along the Seine. According to France's Road Safety Authority, last year alone, 34 people died and 570 were seriously injured while using electric scooters. One key figure in the anti-scooter campaign is a man whose wife was knocked down by one while carrying their weeks-old baby. The French National Academy of Medicine has denounced the scooters as a major health problem. The mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, who once supported scooters as part of wider city plans to reduce traffic congestion, has described them as a nuisance. Her Green Party deputy has questioned the scooters' environmental credentials. "Let's be serious, scooters are not ecological," he tweeted before the referendum, going on to cite research that showed they did little to reduce car usage. Instead, they usually replace walking, cycling, or public transport. Turnout for last weekend's referendum was low, around 7% of eligible voters, but almost 90% approved the ban. Footage from polling stations suggested that the vote was driven by older Parisians, while younger residents, those most likely to use scooters, didn't bother to participate, despite a last-minute mobilizing push by scooter companies. Interestingly, France's transport minister was critical of the ban. The week before, he launched a new national plan to regulate scooters, raising the minimum user age to 14 years and mandating that the machines have brake lights and turn signals. But that might not be enough now that Paris has taken the lead in outlawing rental electric scooters. In February, municipal authorities in Marseille threatened to ban them if operators failed to do more to control their usage. Many in the port city believe the situation is out of control. Pavements and other pedestrian areas are regularly blocked by abandoned scooters. They have also proved a major source of sea pollution, with thousands thrown into the Mediterranean. Residents complain of reckless riders barreling down pavements at speed, sending pedestrians scrambling. "Last November, I was knocked down by a scooter in Marseille when the rider ran a pedestrian crossing after nightfall. I was not injured, but the experience reinforced my view that more regulation is needed." The Paris ban could have ripple effects beyond France, as other cities weigh up whether electric scooters while sounding good in theory, are ultimately more trouble than they are worth. For World Report, this is Mary Fitzgerald in Marseille.
And finally to Africa, where US Vice President Kamala Harris has wrapped up her week-long tour of the continent. She's the fifth member of the Biden administration to visit Africa in 2 years. During her tour, she pledged $500 million in funding to several African nations. From Kenya, Amy Nirieda has more.
Kamala Harris was welcomed in Zambia as a daughter of our country. It was the first stop on her 7-day tour and a sentiment that would follow America's first black vice president to Ghana and Tanzania. According to commentators, her trip was part of an ongoing attempt to steer influence away from China during a time of economic uncertainty. China has invested heavily in Africa in recent decades, including in infrastructure and resource development, while Russian influence has also grown, including through the deployment of troops from Russia's private military contractor, Wagner Group, to aid governments in several countries. Despite reports that some nations, such as Kenya and Zambia, have defaulted on hundreds of millions of dollars in loans from Chinese banks, the vice president was adamant to portray the continent as innovative and rich with business opportunities. She also touted two statistics repeatedly, that the median age on the continent is 19, and that by 2050, 1 in 4 people on the planet will live in Africa. In Ghana, she met with leaders of African diaspora at the Presidential Palace, where black American celebrities and business people gathered in celebration. She also joined actors Idris Elba and Cheryl Lee Ralph at a recording studio later. Africa has racked up almost $700 billion in debt, of which 12% is Chinese. During Harris's trip to Ghana, she signalled that the United States would invest $100 million for stabilisation and defence in West Africa, with an emphasis on supporting fights against extremist groups. In Zambia, she travelled down a dirt road to tour a farm outside the capital that's using new techniques and technology to boost its vegetable crop, as she highlighted ways to secure food supplies. Numerous studies have established that even though African countries have contributed very little to the climate crisis, the repercussions faced in the continent are substantial. The private sector, she said, will donate $7 billion to a fund designed to help Africa combat and adapt to climate change. The funding is to be used for the promotion of climate-smart agriculture and to tackle the effects of climate change on Africa's food security following 5 failed rainy seasons. She was questioned at a news conference about how the West can demand that Africa go green and forego using its natural resources. She also was pressed on whether wealthy nations would supply $100 billion annually to help poor countries cope with climate change, a commitment made under the Paris Climate Accord. Responding, the vice president said there were opportunities in the clean energy economy in Africa that could help generate growth, and that she's waiting for Congress to do its work. At the end of last year, the US committed $55 million to the continent over the next 3 years. Her trip also coincides with the introduction of an anti-LGBTQ+ bill in Uganda, under which certain acts of aggravated homosexuality can be punished with the death penalty. Standing alongside Ghana's president, Harris said she felt very strongly about supporting the development of LGBTQ+ rights in Africa. A similar bill is making its way through Parliament in Ghana, although questions have been raised about its constitutionality. Asked what she wanted black Americans to take away from her trip to Africa, the message she said wasn't just about how the diaspora came to be. It was about their resilience, the strength, fortitude, their brilliance and their excellence. For many, the trip was hailed as a success, partly due to the distractions in the US with Donald Trump's indictment, but for others, the actions of the US are too little too late. Karen Attia, a columnist with the Washington Post, argued that it's high time for the United States to respond to more than terrorism and economic manoeuvring by China. President Joe Biden says he himself will visit Africa later this year, but questions will continue to be raised over his intentions as the battle for influence over the second most populous continent of the world continues.
And that was Amy Nirieda ending that report from Nairobi. That's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Sharon Lynch, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.